how women founders can get more VC money. Is it okay to judge fake people? The USB brouhaha and hands-on with the HoloLens. All that and so much more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 72, recorded Thursday, February 28th, 2019.
Hello, and welcome to Tech News Weekly. This is the show where we talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I am Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Let's do it.
Let's do it. For the second year in a row, only 2.2% of venture capital funding went to women-led startups. Here to explain why is Allison Capen, founder of Women Who Tech and a co-founder of the Women's Startup Challenge, a contest that aims to solve big problems and fund innovation from women founders. Welcome to the show, Allison.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Thanks for coming. So when you say solving the big problems, you mean things like healthcare and government accountability, environmental sustainability, et cetera, all the big ones. So far, how is the tech world doing in solving those problems?
So frankly, it's a big challenge that the tech world is facing right now. We have some of the biggest problems that are facing not just the United States, but this world, climate change, food insecurity, immigration issues. And the startup world has been so focused on, launching products like Facebook and Uber and all of these kind of like first world problems that the tech world is not really digging into some of the larger issues, and the funding is not also going behind that. So that's what we're really trying to solve with the next Women Startup Challenge, is funding these women-led startups that are taking on some of these huge issues that are facing the world and getting them funded.
So it's not just women in this challenge. It's women specifically that have a startup that is designed to fix these problems that we just mentioned.
That's right. And it, you know, also stems to education issues, health tech, biotech. So it's not really just focused on like social impact, because we don't want to pigeonhole like that. It's really thinking about, honestly, the largest issues that is affecting everybody on this planet. And it's up to the tech sector to be a part of that solution. Obviously, it's not the solution, but I definitely think that technology is a huge part of helping us develop these solutions for the long term.
So it seems to me like, and I'm sure that you would agree, that you know, a really big challenge right now, it's not that women aren't, you know, creating companies. It's that, you know, largely, at least in one facet, VC money is not flowing to those companies. So it's kind of making it a huge challenge, for whatever reason, a big hurdle for women-led companies to kind of offer their voice and their solutions, because the money isn't flowing to them to back it up. I feel like right now, you know, this is a big topic. Obviously, there's a lot of people who are saying that there's an imbalance, and that they're, you know, putting this out in the press and everything. Lots of VCs are calling this to people's attention. But is there enough action behind the scene? Is that money, like, is there enough actionable attention being spent on putting this money in the hands of women who are creating companies that can make a change, that can offer a different voice?
Jason, that is a terrific question, because you are absolutely right. The startup world, the VCs, the media have all been talking about this issue for quite some time, and especially with the rise of the Me Too movement. We have seen so many commitments from investors saying that they are ready to diversify their portfolio. They want to see that pipeline. And frankly, organizations like Women Who Tech have that pipeline. We have over 2,300 women-led startups that have applied to our Women Startup Challenges that are solving problems. But in order for a startup to scale, they need funding to do that. And what we're not seeing is the investor world live up to their commitments to do this. And so that's one of the things that we really want to be tackling right now is to have those investors honor their commitments to diversify their portfolios. And we're one of the few organizations that actually have these incredible women-led startups. Like the problem isn't a pipeline issue. There has been a significant rise in the number of women-led startups. The problem is that the doors are closed to them, and we want to crash them open.
So you said women startup challenges. This isn't the first year you've done this. Tell us about some of the past year, the focuses, and how things have changed since you started.
So we launched the Women Startup Challenge in 2015, and we launched it in partnership with Craig Newmark, who is the founder of Craigslist and Craig Newmark Philanthropies. And we intentionally launched it in partnership with him because we need allies at the table advocating for the funding of women-led startups. So we, honestly, since day one, it has been an amazing, amazing program that we have been able to fund about 8 different startups through our startup challenges. Each startup challenge, we select 10 finalists from an application pool of between 250 and 350 applicants. And then we have an online jury who comes in. They evaluate all of these startups, and these are investors, they're tech serial entrepreneurs, and they select the top 10 to pitch. We partner with Google, we partner with LinkedIn, we partner with Microsoft, mayors of cities like in Paris and London to co-host the startup challenges with us. And the startups they're phenomenal. Like, we walk out of the startup challenges and investors are coming up to us and they're like, I can't believe these startups aren't funded or aren't funded at the same level as the startups that they're seeing getting funded that are men. So we have the traction. These startups are game changers. Like I said before, they just need funding.
Yeah. You wrote an article for Forbes back on December 31st of last year, The Revolution of Women is Coming. And one of the stats that you point out, you point out the ROI advantage for women-led startups, 35% higher return on investment than all male teams. Can you give some insight into that, some background as far as what does that say about these startups? Why is that number so much larger?
I think that the number is so much larger. And by the way, this isn't also just about women. It's also about people of color.
Right.
Is that when you have diverse perspectives, not just on the team, but on the founding team and leading products, they're looking at products from a different lens than a traditionally white male team is. So when we create products, we're creating it for the masses. And so one of the reasons that I think that they are so much more lucrative in terms of their return on investment is because they have a much more diverse perspective and therefore a much wider market. It's not just catering to white men. It's catering to very, very diverse perspectives that, frankly, people want to see in terms of the products that they're using. So I think that's one of the reasons that you're seeing such a strong return on investment. I also think that women in particular, and also people of color who aren't funded as much as white male startups, they are used to operating on extremely leaner resources in order for them to survive. And so I think that they have managed to find ways, frankly, to honestly be more lucrative because they don't want to fail. They want to succeed. And so they hustle a lot.
Mm-hmm. So you're accepting applications now. What are the requirements for people to apply for the challenge?
So the core requirements are obviously you have to be a woman-led startup, and we define that as having at least one woman founder or co-founder on the team. You can't have raised more than $2.2 million for the startup challenge. We feel once you've raise more than $2.2 million, you're probably well on your way to raising your Series A. And then obviously solving big problems. That's the theme of this Women Startup Challenge. And we're really excited with the applications that we're seeing. And we already have over 150 applications submitted. We just launched the program about a week ago. So we have 3 more weeks to go, and I think we're going to get a ton of applications. We're really excited about it.
So that's a lot of work to go through all those applications and figure out who the winner or the winners are. What are the prizes? What is the prize, or what are the prizes? Does this go to multiples, or are you picking out a single, or what's the end game?
So this Women's Startup Challenge is taking place at Google in New York City. So the 10 finalists will go to Google on May 29th and pitch their startup to some rock star investors. And then the investors will select the winning startup to receive a $50,000 grant by our nonprofit. It's equity free. And then the next day, we also will have a mentoring day with a series of investors where the startups will meet one-on-one with different investors to talk through their startups. And that's being co-hosted by Techstars. So it's not just about the $50,000 grant. This is about opening up a large network of investors to women-led startups that, frankly, have been shut out.
So I'm sure you get a lot of, what about the men startup challenge? Because that's probably
that
on Twitter.
Life?
That's life. Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Took the words out of my mouth.
And I think you've answered that pretty well with everything you've told us about the challenge and why it's important. The news this morning in CNBC just a couple hours ago, they posted a story about the Bumble co-founder. Bumble is the dating app which puts women first. And so they have presented the Bumble Biz is the new idea. And it sounds to me it's just like a filter where people can just see resumes from women. What are your thoughts on this?
So I think that this is one tool that is needed to, frankly, diversify. Like when we're talking about the tech sector, as we all know, there are huge recruitment issues within the tech sector. And so I think that this is one way to help solve that pipeline issue for HR people in terms of their recruitment. So I think it's a step in the right direction. Do I think that this is only how we should be recruiting? Of course not. But I think it's one piece of the pie that we should be looking at.
Yeah, I would completely agree with that. This kind of ties in with one of my kind of overarching questions that I had in kind of preparing for this interview is that there's a lot, like there is a ton of attention being placed on diversity, for rightfully so, in hiring practices and technology all across the board. And thankfully that's happening. There's a lot more awareness. I think the potential problem is that we suddenly hit some sort of, point where people are experiencing diversity fatigue, where kind of the effects of all of this attention start to numb away. And this might be too broad of a question to answer, but how do women startups, as one example, how do they overcome that diversity fatigue to kind of cut through it and make sure that they're paid the attention they deserve?
I mean, honestly, I think that you just have to keep at it. I hear you, what you're saying, that we've been talking about this for years. And the truth is, I hope that in 10 years, you and I aren't sitting here having the same conversation, because we will have made such significant progress that we don't have to have these conversations anymore.
Absolutely.
But right now, that's not the reality, frankly. So it's up to people like you and I, and allies are a huge part of helping to solve this problem. We can't do it alone. It's not a women's problem to solve. It's an everyone's problem to solve. And so if we can all get together and solve this, then I think in 10 years, we won't be sitting here having this conversation, because it'll just be a natural part of the recruitment process for HR that they have plenty of diverse candidates. Same thing with startups, that all types of startups with people of all different backgrounds are getting funded. And so that's my ultimate goal in doing this.
Mm-hmm.
And when you think about how the startup world works, I mean, it's often people are finding people that, that look like them, that know them, to support, and so the more female women-led startups, then that's going to be an exponential growth, one mm-hmm. hopes.
Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the goal is to see more diverse startups funded, exited, and then that puts more money back into the startup world to fund more diverse startups. So that's the ultimate goal.
Allison Capon is the founder of Women Who Tech. They bring together more than 10,000 diverse engineers, entrepreneurs, startup founders, investors, and industry leaders. You can find it at womenwhotech.com. Is that the best place for people to find out more and also apply to the challenge?
Yes, that is the best place to find out more. And we are a network of 65,000.
Oh, 65,000. Sorry.
Yeah, that's okay.
That must have been
a whole lot more.
Okay. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Take care. Best of luck.
Thank you.
By now, you're probably all familiar with the website thispersondoesnotexist.com. It's the creation of Philip Wang. He designed it to raise public awareness of the recent work by NVIDIA to create new technology that would generate a data set of fake human faces. If you're not familiar with it, go to thispersondoesnotexist.com. And after you look and feel completely creeped out, you'll wonder if things could possibly get creepier than that. And they can. Digital creative director Mark Solomon decided to use the face generator to create a website where you can essentially swipe right or left on these AI faces. It's called Judge Fake People. And maybe we can take a look at this. Judge, are you ready? There's a bit of a warning.
I'm ready.
So Alex is ready. So these are all fake people. And you can decide if these fake AI generated people are hot or not. I went through and called them all hot because, I mean, even fake people deserve love. Do you, Jason, think that it's morally okay to decide if a face created with AI is hot or not?
I mean, I think I feel like, okay, it's probably morally okay because they aren't real people necessarily. Uh-huh, and in a, to a certain degree, this is art, right? Like, this is just computer generated art.
Mm-hmm.
It's a computer's interpretation of what a human might look like based on what it knows, and it creates something. So it's creative. And to that degree, sure, I think it's okay to call something good or convincing or even hot. If it's created, this just happens to be created by a machine. I think what would be creepier is if the AI actually matched back and you could meet that fake person for a date.
Oh yeah, like so if it was actually a dating service, and then that could be
then
like
you could meet the rope fake, the, yeah. the fake person. Yeah.
Yeah,
that would be a little weird.
Yeah,
but you know what? Probably not entirely unlike impossible in the future. That seems to be weirder and weirder with every day.
Yeah, I don't know what to make of this fake faces.
It is interesting. It dawned on me, and I hated that I had the realization, but this would be a really good tool for internet trolls to come up with fake faces for their fake social media accounts. Again, I'm sorry, I just said that out loud. But this is all based on code that you can actually get if you want to get this code. It's called StyleGAN. It can be found in GitHub. It's a TensorFlow code is posted there. And I think, you know, it always kind of goes back to, well, what is this leading to if our eyes are deceiving us and these people? I mean, you look at that list and every once in a while you'll see something that has like long hair on this side and short hair on this mm-hmm. side, or you see a weird little blurb in the face that, you know, feels like a mistake. And those are the ones that really pull you out of the kind of the trance of these people are not fake. They're real. They must mm-hmm. be real. But most of them look super convincing. And what does that lead to down the line, if it's so hard to trust our eyes right now with this stuff, where is it leading to?
Yeah,
you know what I mean? The potential for people to abuse that. Yeah, nowhere good. Actually, OpenAI decided against releasing. They had a text generating AI system. I think this was like a month or two ago. And it was so good at writing convincing text, at mimicking how humans write words, that they actually kept it from being released publicly because they were worried about what that might lead to. So even the companies and the individuals behind creating this technology are starting to become really aware of like, okay, well, what does this lead to?
Mm-hmm.
We should, you know, maybe you can't bottle up that genie. The genie's already out.
Right, exactly. You start with fake faces and then where does it go from there?
I'll tell you where. It goes to cats.
Oh, right.
This cat does not exist.com.
Does not exist.
Keep refreshing and you'll see a new fake cat with every refresh.
That's cat pieces.
Yeah, that one's a little weird. All right, so it's not perfect, but these are not real cats.
No.
It also goes to anime characters, fake anime characters. I'm guessing there's nothing NSFW on this site, but if you refresh, you'll see different fakely generated anime characters. Mm. And then it also goes to fake home rentals. Oh. All of these homes were fake generated by AI examples of what a home might look like in the inside.
Interesting.
So it's going in lots of different places right now.
This dog does not exist because dogs are too beautiful to be turned into AI.
Well, this dog does not exist.com. I mean, I don't know. Someone must have bought that URL. Yeah. The site is blocked due to a security threat. So don't go there. definitely do not go to thisdogdoesnotexist.com. We are not responsible for whatever happens to your computer.
Apparently, Russell, who does our IT, thinks
he knows.
Yeah. I mean, you could probably go there, but we're very... we're blocked from all the good stuff.
We don't recommend going there because who the heck knows what's going to happen. Here's a little story. This is a tough one to get through. Yeah, so
I'm here for you.
Follow me. Okay. Yes. I hope I don't lose you. About the naming convention for a little thing we use enough to take for granted. That's USB. Once upon a time, the USB 3.0 spec was created. Everyone loved it because it bumped up the data rate from 12 megabits per second in USB 1.1 and 480 megabits per second in USB 2 all the way up to 5 gigabits per second. And that's awesome. Yay for USB 3. Okay. Then a new specification was needed for a newer, faster flavor of USB that doubled the rate up to 10 gigabits per second. We all love progress, so that's awesome. Except the revision wasn't named USB 4 like it should have been, or even just USB 3.1. They opted for renaming all those old flavors. So the 5 gigabit per second version was renamed from USB 3 to USB 3.1 Gen 1. And named the 10 gigabit version to USB 3.1 Gen 2. This meant that hardware manufacturers could simply print on the box USB 3.1 support. And people might then assume that it's the 10 gigabit flavor when in fact it's still just the 5 gigabit flavor. So, you know, no truth in advertising. I hope you're still with me. Your hand is resting. Your head is resting in your hand, which tells me you might be a little bored. Okay. So hopefully you're following me at home. So now a newer, faster flavor of USB will support 20 gigabits per second. That's double the speed of USB 3.1 Gen 2. So obviously the right thing to do is to change the names around again. So USB 3.2 Gen 1 is the 5 gigabit per second flavor. USB 3.2 Gen 2 is the 10 gigabit per second flavor. And I'm sure you can guess what the name of the 20 gigabit per second flavor will be, right? If you guessed USB 3.2 times 2, then you would be exactly right. Except why on earth would you have guessed that? Because what the hell is that? The moment of silence was necessary because this just doesn't make any sense to me. My brain just exploded.
Why can't it just be USB 1, 2, 3?
That's a great question, Megan. I'm happy you asked that because that's what any sane person would have done. But no, they keep renaming the old versions to new versions. And like they must have a method to their madness. This probably means that we're going to start seeing on boxes USB 3.2 compatible. And in this case, that means that it could either be 5 gigabits per second or 10 gigabits per second or 20 gigabits per second because there's no definition around that. Probably hardware manufacturers, good ones, are going to actually specify on the box what that actually means. But I don't think that's going to encompass everybody. And it's only going to get more confusing. And apparently the 2x2 thing, right? Like that's because they say 20 gigabits per second is not delivered in a single lane. It's delivered in two lanes at 10 gigabits per second per lane.
So that the core doesn't have to be shorter or longer.
I don't know if it's just more wires on the inside. So two different paths instead of one single path. So to denote that, they say, well, 2x2 instead of...
Right.
It's just...
Could I offer you some Thunderbolt?
Yeah, well, sure. Do you have some with you?
No, but that...
Because I have a headache right now. Does Thunderbolt help with a headache?
No. Oh. It's just got one more easy to understand name.
Yeah.
And according to The Verge, they have some marketing names too. Like there's... Super speed USB super speed. And super speed USB 5 gigabytes or 5 gigabits,
gigabytes,
bits. Then don't even get me started on that. I think this is
Oh, boy.
Well, there's no standards committee? Is that like just decided we'll call it whatever we want to call it?
Well, no, the USBIF is the standards committee.
So there's too many people on that committee.
And they have decided that instead of naming numbers, keeping numbers the same, so, you know, the slower version could still be USB 3.0 instead of 3.2 point whatever revision generation, you know, whatever. Like, they keep changing the old versions up to the latest of the new version, but adding to the end of it. It's just confusing for the consumer, right? Like, I can't think of anything more confusing for the consumer than to change the specification that people have gotten used to and then add obscurity to it because, you know, yeah.
Or you
so
can go for
there is a standards party body, and they just aren't doing a very good job as far as I can tell.
Right. I mean, yeah, you could go from the iPhone 8 to the iPhone 10, which is an X, but you pronounce it 10, too.
Right.
There's that.
There is. At least they didn't put an X at the end, and then everybody's wondering why you aren't just saying 10. Apparently, version 3.2 was originally announced in 2017. The fact that they're doing this now basically says that somewhere soon, the final release of this new spec is going to take place. So there's good news there. Faster speeds coming to USB. You just might not know what you have until you test it out for yourself.
Okay.
Wah, wah, wah. Did we lose you? We lost Megan. So, shifting gears a little bit from all that madness, on Sunday, Microsoft held a big reveal event for its HoloLens 2 mixed reality hardware, the first major revision of the headset since version 1 released back in March of 2016. While HoloLens has always been, I feel, an intriguing piece of gear, it was limited in many ways so that users couldn't help but notice and point out time after time. Does the sequel address these limitations? Well, joining us to give his take on the HoloLens 2 is Scott Stein from CNET. Welcome to the show, Scott.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. So you got the chance to experience a hands-on demo, or I guess face-on demo, of the new hardware. On paper, before actually putting the headset on, were you happy with what Microsoft announced as far as the changes made to HoloLens 2 compared to some of the limitations that we knew about the first headset?
Well, I think if you know, thinking about it, is it going to be a headset for everybody? It's disappointing that that's not, but seeing what's out there in the landscape, that's probably not a surprise at this point. And certainly, like, if you look at Magic Leap or others where they're promising a lot of wild ideas, what Microsoft was showing was it was a really reined in, a very sober, business-like approach. So I do want to see more, but I think from a practical standpoint, I really like that they're attending to some things that these headsets need. I think that the headset feels a lot more comfortable. I love that it works with my glasses. The eye tracking was very easy to use even with glasses on. And, you know, while I think they need a controller at some point or some sort of feedback, the focus to making things easier to use with your hands makes sense for what they're doing. And I think that's something that this tech needs to be better at. So I like all those focuses. I think those are important, and them getting the field of view bigger, but it's not everything it needs to be yet. And I think Microsoft also acknowledges that. So the question is, how much of a stepping stone is this to what the next phase is? But it's an interesting step.
It's always about what's next. Even when we review, you know, when a company releases the next version of the hardware, it's like, okay, that's great, but what's coming after this one? It's like we don't rest. Yeah. So talk a little bit about the hand tracking then. Did it feel more natural? Were there areas that you were like, that's just not quite reined in? Like, what would you envision it should enable, and did it satisfy that for you?
That's a good question. Well, hand tracking, compared to the first HoloLens, for those who had used it, was basically like a click your finger and point. So there was no real motion control per se. Going from that, it was much more like there were a few very set demos where I would take objects and I was grabbing a corner and pulling, or they had a dashboard where I could push things. And that was nice to see. But I've also seen stuff at the really high end, like I would say a Leap Motion, that like a near range hand tracking that I've seen with VR headsets where, you know, you can see all your hands moving and, both your hands, and you can see, the way they move. I didn't see that element, although Microsoft promises that they're 25 points per hand. So I didn't get to see a hand outline. It felt good, but the thing that's missing is still a sense of feedback. So, you know, if I'm grabbing an object it is still weird to know, like, when did you really grab it? And sometimes there were times where I would feel that literally your hand's kind of passing through the ghost of it, and you're supposed to kind of grab it from the middle and pull. And so the question of precision on that, like, when do you really click it, so to speak, with your hands, might be something that's a little bit weird in practice.
And in your experience with it, I'm kind of curious, like, what would you envision would be a good solution for that? I mean, I'm trying to, like, picture how you add that, like, feedback into your hands when you pick up an object. On one hand, it's really great to have the open kind of world experience of you don't need a controller. You just use your hands in the air. But on the other hand, that feedback would be super important. So what would that be? Would that be possibly in the future, like, some sort of, like, outer hand glove of some sort that gives you that kick? Would that be satisfying, do you think?
That's a good question. You know, gloves are definitely out there that have haptics. I think that's interesting. But then, of course, and then you have to start putting on these gloves to use it, which would be annoying.
More stuff.
VR uses those controllers. And I asked Alex Kittman, who created the HoloLens and the Kinect, about that. He said, sure, we could create controllers like that, but they don't seem to want to do it yet. Maybe they will. I think those controllers are nice in VR for those who are creating in VR, because you can do stuff very quickly with a fast feedback and not have to always be physically grabbing. I think over time, the question is, does that reaching for stuff become fatiguing? Mm-hmm. But I also wonder if, like, I keep thinking about smartwatches. You know, like, what if you wore something on your wrist that would buzz and give you feedback? So maybe that would be enough. I think, like, just a little something to give you a sense of when you're contacting things. If they really want people to create with this, and I think they do even from an industrial sense, I don't know how much this is going to get annoying in the long term. You know, are you going to feel like you're doing too much of this? But then again, Microsoft is also saying you'll be using your laptop and you'll be using your phone as well.
Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about the app guides. Now, was that just for the enterprise, or is that something that I could use to, like, fix my microwave or, like, do open heart surgery on myself?
Put together your IKEA furniture.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm more concerned with being able to do open heart surgery on myself.
Yeah, to set up your own open heart surgery on your own. Microsoft did suggest that it's like using PowerPoint, that it's what I saw was a set demo where we didn't get video of this, but I was in what looked like a tool shop with a real tools and a real ATV on a pedestal. And they'd set it up where it was kind of like Google turn by turn directions, but, you know, 3D, where each step that you click through would say, okay, now go get that wrench. And then the arrow would be drifting over to the wrench on the table and you grab it. And then it would say, go to this thing and tighten. And the arrow would, like a 3D Lego kit or something, would then point to the part to fix. That was pretty cool. But the question was, you know, how easy is it to create, which they said is as simple as creating these kind of cards, like a deck of directions, and then I think drawing in the air to do that. But I'm also curious about how you deal with programming when people don't follow your directions. So, you know, it's just like Google Maps. If you're making the wrong turn, you pick up the wrong tool. I'm not sure that it right now will autocorrect to recognize and help guide you, which I feel like in a real work setting, you'd go off road. And if you're not following, it's not a Lego kit. It could be open heart surgery or whatever it is. So, that I'm not sure about. I'm not sure about the branching tree thing of how interactive or aware this can be. But it's meant to be that people can create this themselves, like a little step-by-step kit to then share with somebody else to use.
I think the comparison to maps is super appropriate for a number of different reasons. Like, I know when I navigate somewhere, like, you know, drive around Petaluma is pretty small. Often I will navigate because it's easier for me to, you know traffic and understand traffic and everything. But what I realize over time is that it's made me rather stupid as far as, like, actual street names, because I'm always relying on this hardware or where it is. I don't ever actually look at the street names or anything. So when I have to, like, go into my brain and come up with those details, it's harder for me to do that. In this case, like, I imagine, like, if you're being walked through these steps to put something together, if your purpose is to learn how to do it, that, you know, that detail might actually be lost on you, because it's so much easier to just follow the instruction and walk through it. What do you retain?
That's a very good question. It's one that I mentioned in my story, and I had asked them when I was there because it popped in my head too. I don't think they have a clear answer for it yet either, and I think they're going to realize that that will be a challenge. I would guess, I think there was a story last year written on CNET by another writer, Kent German, was looking at the London system with cabbies and the knowledge. You know, the idea that they don't like to have those map systems, they want to memorize and know it themselves. So I kept thinking about that, exactly like you said, that how much does following the directions in any sense in what we do affect our knowledge retention, and what are the ways that, I mean, that's been explored, I think, too, in a lot of ways of digital learning, the question of how much retention there is. And I'm super curious about that. I think that is a good question with this. And I don't, they didn't propose any definitive answers or numbers in that regard. But I think that's another big, that's a really big question mark for this for training.
Mm-hmm. So you said it has the ability to sense our emotions and focus. And I can see where that could be really useful on like a factory setting floor, or again, the open heart surgery, focus is good. But what are some of the possible nefarious issues with a headset sensing our emotions?
Well, there are a lot. So there's a lot of stuff that could be concerning. If you think about the fact that we're in an era where all of our data about ourselves is kind of collected, made in algorithms, we're sort of like living models to be studied. We have this with quantified self and fitness trackers. So capturing emotion or capturing where our eyes are looking, I've talked to a lot of people who work in AR and work in these fields that have suggested research, and I'm looking at this too, but how much that suggests intent, how much that can flag what you're thinking about, and whether there'll be algorithms that connect those, and will that mean you'd be flagged? Would that mean that would be used to identify your interest in something? Kind of sounds like mind reading, and it may not be far from that, which is kind of crazy. Basically, once you have, and there is eye tracking already out there on a professional level where it's being used for that, to look at heat maps of where people are looking. And when you have that deployed on a larger scale, right now, enterprise, it's kind of covered under the umbrella of who's opting into that. But on a consumer level, there are all sorts of questions. I mean, you look at like anyone, Google or Facebook or people making VR headsets. What will happen with that data? What will it be used for in apps? Right now, there's a lot of talk about security, about how that gets locked down. But that was also the talk about a lot of other types of data in the past decade or more. So I think that's a big question. And I'm also curious to a Microsoft, Alex Kitman. He was talking about how it can help just be more aware of where you're looking and what you're doing, and again, kind of forge the gap to have AI and other software programs seem to meet your interests. But yeah, it gets very weird about that. What happens with that? And it will be a way of knowing where your eyes are wandering.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, from an enterprise level, yes, you opt into it. But then there's the idea of, what are your rights as an employee? I mean, you think about how Amazon employees are treated and others, like in terms of, for the sake of efficiency, like if you are working on an assembly line where, you get your pay docked if you look away from, mm-hmm. I don't want to go all dystopian, but I do want to go all dystopian.
Yeah, pretty easy to go all dystopian.
It's very easy. Yeah. That's a big question. And also that goes right into efficiency. Flight simulator software programs or others that are using eye tracking now that are looking at how people are paying attention to try to understand where maybe mistakes are made or where attention drifts. It might help design the way a factory or a layout or an interface happens. But then it's also how they'll look at efficiency and understand, when you weren't paying attention every moment. It's hard. You don't really have control over your eyes that much. And I think that's going to be a really interesting question, how they interpret that, because I don't see people being able to really control where every moment of attention is at any time. It's really impossible. And so where does that get folded in?
Yeah, no kidding. Well, speaking of our eyes, not only the technology, the eye tracking technology, but I feel like one of the bigger complaints or downsides to the first version of the HoloLens was the narrow, almost stamp like small window that you look through to represent all the virtual items that you see. It's not as expansive as Microsoft makes it seem when you're watching their demo videos online. It looks like you're surrounded and everything is believable. In reality, on the first HoloLens, it was a very small window where your field of view actually saw anything, and around that, it was just kind of all cut off. It's improved on the HoloLens 2. What did you think of that? Was it enough of an improvement? Obviously, I have to imagine this is one of those places where every time they're going to broaden this out even further.
Yeah, and there's been a lot of talk about all over the place, you know, in terms of like what numbers are shared and what information. And this is experiential, so it's tough. It's 52 degrees diagonal field of view for what that's worth. And numbers and charts have been, you know, determining. Microsoft has not gone on record with anything more than 52 degrees diagonal and a certain aspect ratio, which when you can compare it, can see. If you hold it, if I'm estimating, which is what I had to do, it was kind of like this, looking through the headset, mm-hmm. and the original was more like that. And so it was more like a deck of cards versus like a paperback type of book. So when they show demos that were on a table that were about a couple of feet away from me, at least this is more like a TV window where everything's framed, but there's clearly spots where it disappears. And compared to a VR headset, which is like a 100-degree field of view, and then human vision, which goes like, it's like kind of a 180, 200 degree, you know, it's all the way out here, but you're not really aware of it all. So you definitely notice that it's not there. Magic Leap, you know, the question of versus Magic Leap, it was hard because I didn't have a Magic Leap there. It felt more expansive. And I think that in comparison estimates, it looks like it's a little bit more expansive, but it's close. So, it, you know, but the answer is that if you had been using a VR headset and you tried on any of these, you would think, you'd still think, oh wow, I'm looking through a window. That's not as expansive as I thought. But it's a good step forward for them. They clearly had to make some effort with their display tech to even get to that point. But there's a lot more that needs to happen with that. And I even wonder, are they going to have some sort of like ambient information on the periphery? You know, something that when you can't see it, especially on a mission critical anything. I mean, if they, you know, questions which they wouldn't really answer about the military. Or, you know, certainly that, or industrial, when you can't see something, what are you going to do? And there needs to be some indicator here. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you're just going to lose the thread, and that's going to be a problem. Mm-hmm.
So when the first HoloLens was announced in 2015, you know, I was very excited to be able to play Minecraft with my kids in the living room. And of course, my kids have grown out of Minecraft by now. How far do you think, I know this is for the enterprise and we can't, you know, shouldn't be expecting that, but how far do you think it is from being in the enterprise?
Like for enterprise versus like home?
I mean, like when do you think we'll actually see, I mean, is this ready for the enterprise?
That, you know, that's a very good question. I think it's going to depend on, I think it's a specialized tool. I think this is something that for people of $3,500 that want to put this in a very special environment. I mean, their company Spatial was mentioning Mattel ordering hundreds of these for toy design. You know, if somebody using it for simulation training or exploring that a lab. But I remember meeting last year with Verizon on a here in the city, and I asked them about these types of headset devices for deployment with workers in the field. And everything there was about practical, low cost, durable. And they were using tablets at that point and saying no to headsets because they were worried about distraction or tangling. So I don't know. And that's a good, I mean, not working in factories, not working in industrial environments, I still think there'd be a ton of questions. It's also, Microsoft's leaning on the cloud for this, and this is not going to be a 5G device. So what, you know, what's the connectivity like and how mission critical will that be? I think a lot of times you're talking about those field environments. Sure, if you're just scouting something out or teleconferencing, but if it's something that really needs to be done reliably and without a doubt, I don't know. I don't think that would, this sort of floating virtual feel might feel really distressing and not the thing that they would want to go with. I don't know. To be determined. I'm curious about it too.
Yeah. Microsoft missed the 5G memo, apparently. Everybody else had 5G on their roadmap. This could have benefited.
Right. Like they're not there yet, but clearly, and then battery life, but it sounds like part of it. You see plenty of other AR headsets are going to plug into 5G phones, apparently, too. So that's another part of it.
Yeah, absolutely. Scott Stein with CNET. Scott, it's great to get you on the show. We really appreciate your time. Where do you want people to follow your work online? Where can they find you?
You can follow on CNET and on my Twitter handle, JetScott, where I'll post stuff. And yeah, those cover it. I've got an author page on CNET, too, where you can see the stories that I'm posting.
Right on. Scott, it was great talking with you. We'll talk to you soon.
Hey, thank you.
Keep up the great work. Appreciate it.
Oh, Thanks a lot. Thanks for having me on.
Take care. And I think that's it, because we did the stories of the week in the middle. Sometimes we like to play around with the order, you know. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like a sandwich. Sometimes you don't always want the bologna right next to the lettuce. Right, Megan? Mm-hmm. Your bologna and cheese sandwiches?
I don't eat bologna, understand the metaphor.
All right, good. Phew, I'm not totally lost. Appreciate your support, Megan. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 11 a.m. Pacific at twit.tv/live. You can be part of the show by emailing us at tnw@twit.tv.
And listen.
Yes.
Subscribe to our show.
Okay.
Just do it. I don't know what you're waiting for. twit.tv/TNW. And if you're screaming at your radio or your TV or wherever you're watching or listening, I've already subscribed, then tell someone else to subscribe.
Yeah.
And also follow us on the socials. We're on Twitter, on Instagram, et cetera, all the places. And if you want to tweet at me, please go all dystopian at me. I'm on Twitter at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell. CC me, please. Thanks to Burke. Thanks to Alex. Thanks to John, everybody who helps us do the show each and every week. And thanks to you for making me a bologna and cheese sandwich. We'll see you next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.